note.
Because you might want to invest in waterfront real estate. Or sell while you can. I don't know. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, coming to you today from Pioneer Square at the charming event space Little London Plain. Charming people, too. It's a beautiful spot. We're just a few doors down from the big London Plain, the London Plain, three blocks from where Bertha is asleep. I can just, if it wasn't for this building right here, you can see the big red crane over the rescue pit. We're going to be talking about Bertha, and, you know, after the viaduct falls, of course, comes the new Seattle waterfront. We're going to get at that because my guests include the co-chair of the waterfront steering committee, former Seattle Mayor Charles Royer. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. The first person I ever interviewed as a 19-year-old KUOW work-study student.
How'd you do?
You tell me. How'd I do? I tell you, if you had cussed me out, I wouldn't be here. I would not have gone into journalism. You know how it is?
Right.
Your first assignment, so you were gracious. Longest-serving mayor in Seattle history,
you bet.
Right?
12 years.
Well played. Crosscut columnist Knut Berger, welcome to you. Good to see you.
Hey, Bill.
Now, good to be here. You don't see the waterfront the same way as Charlie Royer. Is that fair?
I live a lot further away.
You guys kind of had a back and forth in print.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah. He called you a mossback.
Well, I call myself a mossback.
That's why it wasn't
the sting
out of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why we sat you right next to each other. Also, from the Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter, who just climbed out of Bertha.
Just climbed
Welcome.
Out of Bertha. I wanted to get in the middle of the fight. I didn't know, you know, exactly how to do that, so I wanted to go in there and see what was going on.
You're there. 2 days ago, you were down on the hole.
Down under.
Yeah, okay.
It's quite a sight, everybody. Quite a sight.
We'll talk. Well, so our special focus today is Pioneer Square and the tunnel and the waterfront. We're going to meet our host, Seattle Restaurant. He says he's not a mogul. Restaurateur, restaurant major domo Matt Dillon is going to talk with us in just a few minutes. Hi, Matt. Thank you for hosting.
Thank
Fantastic
you.
Fantastic space. Yeah. So we're going to talk you up about the week in review in food and about your experience at Pioneer Square in a bit. But first, what we do is analyze the news, and let's start with the top story, which sadly is what's happening in Paris, which, by the way, has a significant Seattle connection, as I'll tell you. But we all know about the massacre that happened on Wednesday in Paris with the French satirical newspaper. Just today, I've been walking around the neighborhood looking at the Bertha rescue pit and with KUOW in my ear listening to the developments. But there were two separate standoffs, one in Paris, one outside of Paris. Hostages taken, the gunmen, the security forces moved in. And all three hostage takers are dead, is my understanding, unfortunately, along with three of their hostages. So that's the news. And what we want to talk about today is that the editor of this satirical newspaper, Charlie Hebdo, his name is Stéphane Charbonnier, he appeared on a hit list last spring. It was in the English language magazine of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and the hit list is of people wanted dead or alive for crimes against Islam. Also on that list is a Seattle cartoonist who used to be named Molly Norris. She worked at Seattle Weekly, and in 2010, you may remember there had been death threats against the Comedy Central show South Park, which had done an episode about the Prophet Muhammad. Molly Norris's cartoon essentially said, they can't threaten all of us, so do your part. Everybody draw Muhammad. Okay? And part of her campaign was her criticizing Comedy Central for being cowardly for pulling that South Park episode. She told Cairo Radio at the time that we must not be intimidated.
As a cartoonist, I just felt so much passion about what had happened, and I just didn't want, I wanted to kind of counter Comedy Central's message they sent of about feeling afraid.
She didn't want people feeling afraid, so she did this Everybody Draw Muhammad cartoon. She drew a bunch of pictures that could be Muhammad, because who knows, he might have looked like a box of pasta, etc. This cartoon went viral. Facebook had an Everybody Draw Muhammad Day page. Pakistan blocked Facebook over it. Molly Norris got death threats, and instead of declaring that she would die on her feet instead of her knees, as that French cartoonist did, she changed her name. She disappeared. She went underground. So that's what we want to talk about now. Knute Berger, who used to be editor-in-chief at Seattle Weekly, did you know Molly Norris?
She wasn't working there when I was there, but I did meet her during the whole brouhaha. And there's what you stand, you know, a person might stand up for in principle, and I think she was absolutely right in what she was doing, and she certainly believed it. But when a fatwa is declared against you, there really is very little that can be done to protect a person. She went to the FBI, and they basically said, disappear. Get a new identity. Change your name. And so she did.
And she tried to stop the campaign, right? She was saying, okay, maybe this is a bad idea. Do you feel like the Seattle Weekly or anyone involved did anything wrong? And would you publish, you're at Crosscut now, would you publish an offensive, scary, blasphemous cartoon? Would you publish a depiction of Muhammad?
Well, I don't have to make those decisions. I might or I might not. It would depend on the cartoon. It would depend on the context.
That's quite a statement.
The right to say anything doesn't mean everybody has to say anything. We all have the right to say or not say or make statements that, you know, we don't want to make. There's a lot of stuff in Charlie Hebdo in that publication that was really repulsive.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, I mean, a lot of caricatures of Africans, Jews, Arabs, and the kinds of things I personally don't like. But I certainly defend their right to do that. And these kinds of death threats, I mean, they're real. Obviously, you know, they're real. You have to take them seriously. But people also have to make decisions about what they want to stand for, when they want to stand for it, whether they want to live or die in those kinds of situations. And, you know, everybody gets to make their individual decision. That's what freedom is all about.
Charlie Royer, you were a journalist, too, a TV journalist. Any thoughts? Have you been following what happened in Paris?
Oh,
any thoughts on all of this?
Sure, of course. And not only what happened in Paris, but going all the way back to the shocking moments around 9/11. You know, the unbelievable seems to be happening. And with the kind of multiple media in play around this issue, as it should be, I'm just overwhelmed by it. When I was active in television, we had three networks and a public broadcasting network. Today, it's everybody with a cell phone and everybody with access to the internet. So it's just overwhelming, the flood of this horrors coming at us. And I'm kind of wondering how young people and children are perceiving this. And where are the places that they go to talk through these issues? I mean, church attendance is down in the country. In Seattle, it's almost non-existent,
right,
for a big city. So where are the forums other than those religious forums, and where young people in particular, maybe with their parents, can engage these issues and try to figure out why?
Joni Balter, formerly of the Seattle Times, any experience with this?
Well, my thought is, how did journalists become so much the target, as has been happening in the last little bit here? You take this person that you referenced earlier, Molly Norris, she did a bold journalism kind of thing, and then she had to change her entire life. She had to change her name, presumably leave the city. Somebody was in contact with her under some circumstances because she had texted something like, fatwas suck. In other words, her life is so incredibly different. And it's just kind of, you know, sends shivers through your back if you think about it, that journalists have to have these double takes on just what they normally used to do because of this. Now, you know, the New York Times did not publish any of the Charlie Hebdo cartoons. The Post did. The Washington Post did. But these decisions are being made all the time about, in the case of the New York Times, saying, did they want to jeopardize their journalists around the world? They have people all over and in some sort of troubling locations. And so what should they do? They decided they didn't want to, in this exact case, inflame.
Conservative writers around the country are referring to Seattle and talking about the media here being cowards, the Weekly Standard, the Spectator. Imagine what the media would be saying if the Ku Klux Klan were threatening to kill Molly Norris in Selma, Alabama, instead of radical Muslims in Seattle. This writer said, Molly Norris may have anticipated a Spartacus moment when her colleagues at this predictably self-satisfied left-of-center rag, referring to Seattle Weekly, would stand up and say, I am Molly Norris. That did not happen. Was that cowardly?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't think so. I mean, I was feeling...
Je suis coward.
Let me just kind of unpack a couple of things. One is that, you know, I mean, journalists undergo threats and things all the time from people who aren't terrorist cells, and I grant that there's a big difference, but I certainly had experience at the Weekly where somebody was threatening my life and stalking me and had to deal with that. One of the things you find, it's very difficult to get off the radar screen. I had to get an unlisted phone number, and within, I think, 3 weeks, my number was on the internet.
Other people have to grow a heavy beard. You had to shave yours to disappear. I'm sorry, I interrupted. You were saying.
You know, I think that it's something that the society has to stand up for collectively, and I don't think it's necessarily everybody taking the same position. The whole point is we have the right to make individual decisions, but I also think that there's a collective agreement that standing up for the rights of free speech is really important, and I think that takes a lot of different forms. People do it in lots of different ways, and that's the important thing.
Okay, my last question about this. We talk about a threat to the right of free speech. Charlie, you mentioned how many more outlets there are than there used to be. So let's say that the American media are now, the mainstream media, are now afraid to draw Muhammad, or show movie studios are afraid to show Kim Jong-un's head exploding. We have blogs. How important really is this? Is really the freedom of speech at stake, or do we have plenty of freedom of speech and that part's overblown?
You don't have much influence over the speakers because there are so many of them. Also, you know, when I was starting out, and I went to journalism school at the University of Oregon and wanted to be a journalist all my life. But I remember hearing people say in school and then in practice for the next 20 years, you got the right of free speech, but do you have the right to stand up in a crowded theater and yell fire? Now there are so many people who are able to yell fire in a very crowded planet that where is the control? How do you do anything but depend on the good common sense of journalists and people who are making these decisions around issues in the news? How do you influence them other than to say, you know, you are responsible for your actions?
You're listening to a sad KUOW's Weekend Review today in light of what's going on in France. Again, these two hostage-taking situations stormed, terrorists killed, some hostages killed. We've got lots of other news to talk about, happier news to talk about, but also, you know, thorny issues around the place where we are right now, Pioneer Square, a few blocks from the waterfront. We're going to get to all of that this hour on Week in Review with Charles Royer, Joni Balter, and Knute Berger. Bertha next when we come back from a break. Yeah, it's foggy. I can't see the top of the Smith Tower. Last time I checked.
Because it's over there.
I'm looking the wrong direction. Like, where's Mount Rainier? I'm pointing to it, but I can't make it out in the fog. Oh, yeah.
Maybe turn around.
Charles Royer, Joni Balter, Knute Berger, Bill Radke. We're in Pioneer Square with a live audience at the lovely event space Little London Plain. And you, analyzing the week's news. Yes, it's that Charlie Royer, former Seattle mayor. Now he's co-chairing the Waterfront Steering Committee. And we are a few blocks away. I can just about see the red crane of the rescue pit I was visiting before the show, where we're trying to wake up Bertha. So the question I want to start with is, we all know that the tunnel viaduct waterfront project is stalled, but is it in peril? Because listen to what Seattle Mayor Ed Murray said this week. He was asked by Cairo TV, right, about what's going to happen to this tunnel. And listen to this. He said, well,
whether it's a tunnel or whether it's some other type of tunnel or some other type of arrangement that we come up with for the Central Waterfront, the important thing is we find a way to make this corridor work.
Let me play that again for you. Just a portion of it. What was that about the tunnel, Mayor Murray?
Whether it's a tunnel or whether it's some other type of tunnel or some other type of arrangement.
Some other type of arrangement? Former Seattle Mayor Charles Royer, you speak mayor. What is he?
Well,
what did he just say?
Well, on the one hand, Well, I understand his position pretty well.
What is his position?
His position is that he doesn't want to own the tunnel, so he's
that's
trying
his position.
Well, it's the right position. Because the tunnel is now owned by the tunnelers, which is our protection. And he was trying to talk about a plan B in a sort of oblique way. But plan B, in my view, is plan A. Plan A is pretty good. All of the responsibility for completing this job rests with the tunnelers, and they're among the best in the world. And to even suggest, as the mayor did, that there might be something else, another tunnel or something, is to, I think, fall into a pit as deep as Bertha's, which is where the mayor, the governor, the legislature, the city council are making decisions about this tunnel, or think they are, or lead the people to believe they are making decisions, when they don't have ownership of it and they don't want ownership of it yet, according to the contract. There's a $500 million bond that ensures that the best tunnelers in the world who are working on this will finish it. It's kind of like the 787. With all its problems, Boeing could not let that fail. These tunnelers cannot let this tunnel fail. They're bidding for projects all over the world. They're up to their knuckles in legal responsibilities for cost overruns and everything else. This will be settled in the courts, ultimately. They just settled one that has been running for 10 years in the courts. But the point is, let's let them do their work. And let's not try to confuse the situation or confuse people in terms of who really is responsible here. Right now, we have the state has given the tunnel partners responsibility. And they know they have to fix this thing. I've been down on the machine when it first went down, and I walked all the way up to the cutter head and talked to the people who are doing this. They really are pros. They're the best in the world. So I think the alternative is to let them do this, give them some room to do it, enforce the contract, oversee what they're doing. But the alternative is to let the council, the mayor, the legislature, and the governor dig the tunnel. Now, is that what we really want?
Before we go to Joni Balter, quick response, audience, yay or boo? First, yay. How many yays for what Mr. Royer's saying? There is no other alternative. Let's do this thing.
Yay.
Okay, how many boos? A few. Joni Balter.
That's the optimistic Seattle light talking over there. That's really good.
Joni Balter, plan B is for boo. Do we need a plan B?
Well, I'll tell you what. The reason why plan B is a problem and the reason why they're so heavily into some of these leaders into plan A is because plan B is what you would call mush. There just isn't a good one. And we've only spent...
Mush is what Pioneer Square is built on, by the way.
Understand that. Understand that. But the gist of this is that our leaders... including Ed Murray. His name is on the legislation, just for the record here. But our leaders spent years trying to figure out what is the solution, as the mayor referred to it, to this corridor. And this is the solution they came up with. It is, unfortunately, having many problems. I went underground the other day to look at it and see, you know, what do those problems look like. I mean, what's interesting is how much work has been done. I'm certainly not going to
70%.
I am not going to 70%. That is the money that was spent, 70% of the money, but that's not of the work being done.
That was the controversial line the other week from the transportation.
But the gist of this is that plan B, when you push these folks, push on them, what does it look like? Well, maybe it's some kind of speedway along the waterfront that doesn't really accommodate enough of the cars. Something on the old viaduct, 60% of the cars that were traveling it were not stopping in Seattle Thruway. The tunnel doesn't have any exits. So Julie,
don't you think, pardon me for interrupting, but I always love doing this.
Oh, I know. And
the new host of your program is Charles Royer.
You know, this has been going on for 20 years.
Right.
But please proceed.
But I mean, you have just climbed into the pit I was talking about. You're now debating issues that we've been debating for 20 years. It's sort of like Knut's back on the Kalakala again.
Yeah. Have you considered that Plan B for the tunnel could be putting the Kalakala?
I'll tell you what Plan B could turn out to be, which is not a good future for us, is that there's an earthquake, the viaduct falls down while we're arguing about it, and then we're like San Francisco, we've got to recover from a disaster, and we do a half, I won't say the term, use the term. I've been out of politics for a while, so
half
I
half-alect.
Yeah. So you get some half-baked plan that gives you just concrete out there, and no park, no great amenities, no stimulus for the kind of economic development that's happening in Pioneer Square now. And we are a city, I cannot do city in everybody's eyes because we failed again on something. So I just don't want that to happen. That's Plan B in the worst case.
Listen, Knut Berger is clenching and unclenching his fists. So.
Yeah,
we're not getting to waterfront yet, but we're talking about Plan B. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I'm happy to have Seattle be regarded as a can't-do city.
Lesser Seattle lives.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not worried about that reputation. I think the tunnel has to be finished politically. And when Charlie talks about Ed Murray's ownership of the tunnel, he does own the tunnel because he's really the highest profile in-office politician who wanted the tunnel. So I think politically he owns it, and he doesn't want it to be a headache. As far as Plan B goes, to me it's more like, how are they going to make Plan A work? I mean, it's what Charlie was saying. And what doesn't give you a lot of confidence is the kinds of assurances that were given against the kinds of warnings that were given about what would happen. You can go back and read consultants' reports saying A, B, C, D are going to happen if you dig this tunnel, and it's not good. And those things have largely come to pass. So good advice was given and ignored. And, you know, now we're faced with making that work. You know, they still don't know entirely what's wrong down there, so there's a lot of unknowns yet. They have to see whether the fix they've created actually works. They have to dig the tunnel the rest of the way under places that are less accessible than where it's stuck now. So what kinds of assurances do we have that won't get stuck again? Or if it does get stuck again, how do you get in and fix it in a timely manner? So,
well, the answer to that is that you pull all of the back of it off. It's very time-consuming. It looks expensive. I don't have a number on that, but you would have to come in from the very back and deal with the cutter head.
And I think, you know, the issues of who's going to pay for what, you know, will already be in litigation for years. There are going to be issues that arise from damage to city infrastructure that aren't covered by the contract, are covered by other agreements that could cost state taxpayers. And then there's the whole issue eventually that has to be confronted about who's responsible for cost overruns,
you know, just,
if any.
Knut, I think this is not the first time I've been in a discussion with a bunch of tunnel experts who really don't know what they're talking about.
So, see, he hasn't been mayor for quite some time. He forgot that diplomatic thing.
No, that's okay.
Seriously, that's a Chris Christie coming out in me there. For a minute.
next thing, he's going to be hugging the owner of the Dallas Cowboys.
No, not that. But seriously, what you're saying is that good advice was given. Well, by whom? In a political debate where a lot of people who don't know anything about tunneling, and a lot of people who don't know the context of tunneling in the world, in London, they've got 12 tunnels underway, 32 miles of tunnel, digging under that incredibly complex city, and everything's going well. So,
and you know what? This is not the tunnel hour, because we have so much else to talk about.
I know.
This is the week in review.
But let's not always fall back on the arguments about what was done in the past. Let's talk a little bit about the future. And I wish there were some younger people here, who are going to be alive when this tunnel is done.
Wow.
But it won't be alive when it's paid for.
Or the lawsuits are settled.
Anyway, I just think, you know, I'm more interested in the future, even though I'm not going to be around to see all of it. but I'm interested in how we move this ahead. And I think the smart way to move it, I was mayor when we dug the Third Avenue Tunnel. A bunch of lawyers came up to see me and my staff and said, we've got a problem with the Third Avenue Tunnel. The Seattle Tower has just moved an inch, and there are a bunch of lawyers walking around it with legal pads. Uh-huh. And so, you know, things happen in these projects, but we didn't stop the Third Avenue Tunnel. We completed it, fixed the problems, and that's what has to happen right now.
Matt Dillon, what do you think we ought to do about the tunnel? Could we eat Bertha potentially?
I'm actually an expert on tunnels.
Yeah. this is our host, Matt Dillon, by the
French,
way. We're at Little
French
London Plain.
Thank you.
And
I'm going to open a pop-up gastronomic and coffee culture circus show.
Yeah? Well,
some, down inside the tunnel.
There's some hungry construction workers over there I was talking to. But we're in Pioneer Square, which is taking the brunt of the construction and the noise and the disappeared parking and the settling ground. This cafe has sunk 4 inches since we began this show. We're now below street level. Matt Dillon is the owner of London Plain and this event space, Little London Plain, and Sitka and Spruce and the Corson Building and Bar Seor and the old Chaser Farm and the Marigold Mint and a lot.
Yeah,
so we're 3 blocks max from where Bertha is stuck. How has this project affected your life, if at all? Bar Seor is even closer.
Only emotionally, really.
How's that?
I mean, it's scary to think about, you know, when you think about the inner workings of a city and how it's all going to go down. I'm not educated well enough to know the ins and outs of it all, but, you know, when you're as devoted to a city as I feel like I am, anything that's hard to deal with is difficult. You know?
No settling, no cracking?
Nothing
for you.
So far.
Okay.
Only emotionally.
emotional settling. The ground we are on used to be a peninsula, and at high tide, it was an island. Pioneer Square is partly on landfill, sawdust and ball bearings and whatever else they threw out, porridge and DOT pipes is mostly what's under there. And so why are you in Pioneer Square?
It's beautiful. Why wouldn't you be down here?
Well, I asked because we asked our listeners on Facebook to describe Pioneer Square in one word, and I was shocked. They were down on it. I'll just read you a few. Neglected, shady, sinking, that's fair, dark, deteriorating, urine, gritty, frustrating, dangerous, sketchy, decrepit. I could go on.
You've just described a city.
Well, so what's your Pioneer Square?
I wonder how many of those people have actually come and spent time down here recently. You know, I don't know. When you're growing in the rate that Seattle is and becoming a true metropolitan city, you know, trying to run in the same breath as, you know, New York and San Francisco and L.A. and Chicago, there's people in all those cities that are saying the same words. It's an old part of town, and it has been neglected by the people that are outside of it. I think that the people that are inside Pioneer Square have put years and years of work into making this neighborhood viable. And the idea for me, you know, I spent a lot of time down here in the late 80s and early 90s and going to punk rock shows and then, you know, hanging out at Elliott Bay Books. And that was kind of
the departed Elliott Bay Books.
And that was like the first draw for me because it was, you know, it was like a little cultural hub for myself. And to see that go was really sad. And then when Catherine Anderson and I were looking at spaces to open a business together, you know, I probably would have moved Sitka down here years ago, but it just didn't seem right. But when we were looking, it felt good. You could feel the energy of the neighborhood turning, and there were so many amazing people down here, Charlie being one of them, doing really incredible things for the neighborhood. So all the dirt and the urine and the grime and the unfortunate people that are down here, I'd rather be part of that community and try to do more than just stand back in my Finney Ridge house and say, that place smells like, you know.
I talked to one of the audience members who lived.
Thank you.
One of our audience members described it as her neighbors who sleep in their shoes and have loud conversations with God. And that's part of the neighborhood, but, you know, if you haven't been here, it's beautiful, it's thriving, it's in places upscale, it's It's humming.
And
yes, Joni.
It's totally in transition at this point because just, you know, remember what the north end of downtown, also known as South Lake Union, used to look like. Because I used to work there and run out of the Seattle Times building fairly late at night, rain, running to a parking space. There was nobody there. It was just me. So that has changed. And so as we've talked on this show before, the southern end of downtown is about to change dramatically with Weyerhaeuser coming here. It's going to be a much different neighborhood, and it's going to pull the downtown as it might southward.
Yeah, Weyerhaeuser, remember, is bringing 800 to 900 people, their headquarters from Federal Way, right over there on the parking lot next to Occidental Park. Instant change in the game in Pioneer Square. With those people coming to work here every day, most of them on transit because we're the biggest transit hub in the region. That's going to just completely change the park, Occidental, the street life, the lack of civility. There'll be office workers out there, most of them sober most of the time.
And let's not forget that it's a marathon, not a sprint, right?
Yeah.
You know, we live in the age of instant gratification.
As Bertha knows very well.
Right. Yeah.
Bertha is not sprinting.
No.
I saw that.
Speaking of which, we are looking toward the end of the Bertha Tunnel Viaduct thing and remaking the waterfront. Charles Rohrer, you are on the Waterfront Steering Committee. What is your 30-second, like, picture it for us? What's your bubblator speech? What is the waterfront going to be?
It's a major transformation of the entire region because it sits on Elliott Bay, right at the base of this amphitheater, which is Seattle, the city of Seattle, the downtown primarily, and Pike Pine, which looks right down into the water. And it's the disappearance of that enormous wall that we built back in the 50s, and connection is the way I see it. It's the connection from the market with its 10 million visitors to Coleman Dock with its 5 to 6 million and the Stadium District with its 8 million. And it's people walking and enjoying the vistas that they talk about enjoying from the viaduct when they should be watching the road. But we're gonna recreate.
That's a heck of a view on the viaduct. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I got a look.
Well, you ought to see the view that will exist from the Overlook Walk that runs from Pioneer Square down over what is now Alaskan Way, and connects right directly to the water at the aquarium.
Okay.
It's going to be an incredible connection that will extend both north-south as well as east-west.
It sounds incredible. Knut, am I correctly quoting you that you described that same vision as a white elephant?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've been concerned about is creating something that's expensive to maintain. I don't like the idea of privatizing management of downtown parks. I'm worried about the sort of Lake Unionization of the waterfront, seeing, you know, a lot of the businesses down there are reinvesting, and I understand why, but I'm concerned that a lot of the small stuff. I know Charlie hates the shops that sell the space needles, the souvenir shops, and that kind of thing.
Is that fair?
I'm going based on a quote from Charlie.
We don't want T-shirt shops and tourist stuff, and that's not what's going to happen if we build a great palette for private investors to come in and build some nice restaurants and some good public spaces and that sort of thing.
Right. I just don't like that attitude. And, you know, to me, the ye olde curiosity shops and things like that are part of what makes Seattle Waterfront Seattle Waterfront. I want to see that
people
stuff
used to
survive.
Knut, people used to talk, are friends of ours, columnists like Emmett Watson. They loved First Avenue because it was seedy and gritty. Rick Anderson. Mm. They loved First Avenue because it was seedy and gritty, smelled like urine, it was dirty. And then we decided to build the art museum down there. And a lot of people thought that was a terrible idea. First Avenue today is probably the liveliest street in Seattle. And it's a great street.
Well, listen, Knut has said that you're planning something
so
that's very...
So the pawn shops went away, and some of the parking lots did, and some of the little retailers went away. But the ultimate result is a really lively street for everyone, and that's what we see the waterfront as being, a waterfront for everyone, not just for people who want to sleep there during the day.
Joni, I haven't heard from you.
I think that Skip was reacting, and I do not speak for Skip very often.
I will, in a moment.
But I do think that what he was reacting to was that the drawings were just a little you know, a little bit too much bling for Seattle, a little bit too unrealistic of who does or who would end up being at the waterfront.
Those are the Disney drawings.
Those are the we had some fun with the Disney drawings when Charlie Royer briefly hired Walt Disney Imagineering.
So it's where are the clouds? Where are the cars? Well, where are the
clouds,
homeless people?
The rain.
Where's the rain?
The clouds and the rain and the homeless people are adequately represented by people who don't like this idea. But think about what the designer has in mind, and listen to this guy who designed this incredible place in New York, the High Line. He knows about spaces, about public spaces.
This is the elevated walkway. Right. Used to be a train trestle.
So,
right?
So his vision is you don't design, you know, an amusement park. You design a New York loft that is a bunch of different rooms. When it starts in, say, 2016, and different generations who come to the city will put their own imprint on that place. They will say, here's what I want, and I'd like to at some point hear from you and from the audience, what do you want on the waterfront? But the point is that he sees this as not a final design. He sees this as creating opportunities spatially that can be used in a Seattle way, with Seattle people, Seattle entrepreneurs, Seattle users.
Weren't you making the argument that we're spinning too many plates and it's going to be hard to fill and maintain and clean and police?
Yeah, I mean, you want to get in a situation where you have to do a lot of spending of money to activate space. You want to be able to take advantage of as much natural activation as possible. One thing about the First Avenue redo is one of the reasons it was successful was the preservation of the Pike Place Market, not just as a collection of historic buildings, but as a protecting low-income populations and low-income housing downtown. So I think when you do this kind of thing, you really need a very holistic plan, with the exception of a few units of low-income housing that the market is putting in as part of its expansion. There's nothing like that being proposed that I know of anyway.
Why not just a quiet
waterfront in general?
Why not just a quiet green spot? Why does it have to be
a quiet green spot, not managed and not programmed in Seattle, is going to be City Hall Park up by the courthouse.
Okay.
So I know some people disagree with private management, but we're not talking about private management. We're talking about private nonprofit partnerships that will actually manage these spaces so that they're usable for everybody. For the homeless people as well as people who are eating their lunch in the park. You cannot do that in Pioneer Square today. It is too threatening. It's threatening at night, and the activation of this naturally with private investment and with government intervention and with the Alliance and the Parks Foundation and the Downtown Seattle Association managing these spaces, programming them with their own money that they raise. The city can't do it and won't do it. So it's done all over the country. It's not part of our culture, and anything that's not part of our culture in Seattle is suspect, and I think that's legitimate.
Joni, I'll take it as a good sign that you really want to say something, but we have to take a break here. In Pioneer Square, that's former Seattle Mayor Charles Royer, Knute Berger, Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. We're at the Little London Plain. Back at it, the last portion of If Only Bertha Could Say This. We're almost done with Week in Review, but we got to take a short break. KUOW's Week in Review. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Matt Dillon, because he's got this awesome space called Little London Plain. And Matt agreed to have us come in here and analyze the week's news and focus on the waterfront and Bertha and the fog and the tunnel and the viaduct and everything. And this week, the Kalakala. We're focusing on the waterfront, and it's perfect that the nautical space needle is about to be destroyed. This week, the News Tribune reported the 1930s ferry Kalakala will be scrapped this month in Tacoma. The Kalakala was a, to me, beautiful, others disagree, a streamlined steel Art Deco ferry that carried cars across the Sound from the 30s to the 60s. It went out of commission, towed to Alaska, used as a fish processor, towed back to Seattle about 15 years ago triumphantly to be restored. And by restored, I mean warehoused and fought over and cut up with a torch in a couple of weeks. Knute Berger, you think the Kalakala belongs on the new Seattle waterfront.
I would love to see it down there. People, you know, it's interesting. You referred to it as the Space Needle. It was interesting in that it was one of the very first modern space age icons of the city in the 1930s. It was ahead of the New York World's Fair and the sort of streamlined trend that we think of as Art Deco. It was like a rocket ship out there. And even during the World's Fair, when tourists came to Seattle, it was after the World's Fair, it was like the second most popular site in Seattle. People loved watching it cruise out there. And maritime preservation is really fraught because ships are really expensive to preserve and maintain. When it, Kalakala was sold off by the state, it became a fish processor up in Alaska. Some Fremont artists went up and got a hold of it and brought it back to Seattle, put it on the waterfront. Everybody thought this was going to be a great triumph of Seattle quirkiness and proved that their financial limits to quirk.
And now it's a rusting, it's a rusting hulk. And if it were on the waterfront, it would mainly serve to scare the children. We have 3 feet away from you, Knute, co-chair of the Waterfront Steering Committee, former Seattle Mayor Charlie Royer. What do you think, Kalakala, housing a restaurant on the pier there?
Well, I think you'd have to talk to somebody who's going to run the restaurant, whether they want to be on the Kalakala and whether they can afford that kind of space. But I think I totally agree with Knute. Everywhere I look in Seattle, and I've only lived in Pioneer Square for 8-9 years now, but I came to Seattle in 1970, and we all came to Pioneer Square at night to have dinner, and it was just a very popular spot. And then it got into some hard times, and now it's coming back. So I don't wish for 1970 again. I see happening in Pioneer Square what Jane Jacobs referred to in her writings about New York. She said, the new economy needs and loves the old buildings. And the people do. Weyerhaeuser is coming down here because young people want to be in this kind of neighborhood. They want to live here. And it's getting hard for them to afford to live here. But we are getting much more housing. 700 units on the north lot, another 400 and so units
those
in
are
the
tall,
neighborhood.
Though. Do you mind building up? There's a hotel. I walked all this
that's
stuff
not
to
in
this
the
morning.
That's I love
oh,
that.
That's right out of the historic the
I love
district.
That.
Okay.
I love that.
Like this parking garage right here, you could spit on the viaduct from it. That's about 3 stories. That I saw the sign. It's going to be a, what do they say, 8-story?
200 units.
199 units with 78
market
parking
rate,
spots.
Market rate apartments, yep. That will help to activate that waterfront and Pioneer Square, so we don't have to have a bunch of cops around. We got people with their eyes on the street living here. That's going to make the difference. But let me just say one other thing, that these young people down here...
We could turn Kalakala up on its side. It could be a Pioneer Square high-rise.
Yeah, well, that would fit right.
Sorry, go
now.
On.
But I think I was trying to say that we can be... nostalgic about what we're losing, and we're losing a lot. We're losing so much of our planet just kind of shifting off into the Arctic because we're not doing a very good job taking care of it. But the rather than just bemoan these losses, what do we do with this new generation coming up to get them involved in building a place that's going to be something for them as they get to be our age? But, you know, I'm on the Waterfront Committee. I've been trying to get young people involved in this thing because they're going to be around
You're
to see
me,
it.
You're asking me, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I look around every Waterfront Committee meeting, and we've got people with more gray hair than I have. Yeah. And I'm 75, and I'm one of the youngest people involved in that effort. So I'm thinking more about the future. I regret some of the things we've lost from the past. I don't regret losing First Avenue as it was.
Okay, we're back.
Back to First Avenue. So on the Kalakala, I can be sentimental about the old Kalakala, but what has happened to this boat over all this time, it's really expensive, it's rusting, and I'm just, you know, I cannot see what it is now on the new waterfront. I think it, I don't know how they would do it. People have sunk so much money into it.
If only we had a restaurateur here in the room.
Hey, we're, crunch the numbers. It doesn't work.
That's what I'm saying. Matt
Dillon owns Barcior and London Plain. We're in his little London Plain and so much more. Can we do a little news, like week in review in food?
Sure.
Okay, that was some skepticism.
I don't really know what's going on.
Well, the Seattle...
we had our staff party.
Paseo just came back on the scene. The Kalakala wishes it could do this. Paseo somehow reopened, right? Did you even know that? The Cuban shop?
I did.
How good is that sandwich? Because Canute, you have, your food writer at the Crosscut says it's the most overrated sandwich in the city. What do you think?
The last time I had it was about 6 months ago, and it was quite good.
Okay. We have the foie gras ban overturned. Did you hear that? Federal court said L.A.'s foie gras ban. This is the you force feed ducks and geese, and they said it's not illegal. Would you? Will you ever?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Tell me about that.
It's delicious.
Do you serve it?
We do a lot worse things for our planet and for animals that are on this planet than eat foie gras. So.
Where do I find your foie gras?
Well, we're not that type of restaurant.
Uh-huh.
But I make it at home for my my family. I'm just kidding. You
overfeed your pet goose?
I feed it to my dogs.
On last week's show, we told you that the Snoqualmie Gourmet Ice Cream plant was contaminated by its employees' facial hair. And we discussed the advantages of the beard diaper. Canute, you were on the show. Joni, you were on the show. You are a facially hairy guy yourself.
I am.
You can't quite match Canute Berger, but it's an impressive effort. Do you and your employees wear the beard diaper?
No, just regular diapers.
Regular diapers. Okay. By the way, listener Tom tweeted us that the beard diaper has an actual name. Does anybody know what a beard diaper is actually called? This is the... Yes? It's called a snood. There you go. It's your hair net, but it's on your beard. I said on our show last week that Molly Moon and Pink's get their ice cream base from the same place as Fred Meyer and QFC. This is that contaminated plant. Brady at Pink's said, look, when you say it's all the same stuff, that's like saying the Week in Review and the BBC World Service are the same because you can hear them both on NPR.
Ooh,
which, ironically, they're not both on NPR, but they're both on KUOW. Where do you get do you serve ice cream in any of your places?
We do, yeah.
Did you get caught up in the Snoqualmie Gourmet ice cream?
No, we just make our own.
Really? From scratch?
That's the
from the scratch.
Because that was the whole thing was, what do you expect us to do, make our ice cream from scratch? Cue Matt Dillon. Okay, what if you were to make a Bertha cocktail? Any idea what that
should.
Would be?
And you absolutely should.
Really should.
Chartreuse for some good lubrication.
Good.
Boy, what else?
You need an olive.
Soda water
bottom
for those bubbles to help
dislodged.
It get up. Yeah, that's right.
You have a little piece of salmon in it too to talk about the habitat restoration that we're doing with the water.
A straw with a hole in it, so you actually can't get it out, no matter what you do.
It doesn't back up. It can't back up. No way.
Matt Dillon is our host at Little London Plain. Thank you for hosting us.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming down here. You're a lovely crowd. Joni Balter with Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. She contributes to Bloomberg View, and she lost her view a couple of days ago to go down under. And you'll be writing about your visit to Bertha.
Yes,
I will.
Yes, I will.
Canute Berger is at crosscut.com, columnist at Seattle Magazine. Charlie Royer called him a moss back, and he is. Canute, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
For coming.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, Charlie Royer. Former three-term Seattle mayor. It's just been great to have you. Now Pioneer Square resident and co-chair of the Waterfront Steering Committee.
Well, thanks for coming to Pioneer Square. This is a big deal for us to have you here and to have all these people gathered around this beautiful space today.
Thank you to the KOW Operations Department. Our community engagement folks made this happen. Thank you again for being here, audience. On Facebook, we're at KOW Public Radio. We're on Twitter, at KUOW, and we are going to be back again next week on KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks, Little London Plain!